Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. It's the law. Federal law requires that campus police notify the public when violent crimes are reported on campus. OSU is beholden to that law, as well as any university in the country. It has a different policy, apparently, for sexual assaults, however. Since 2006, OSU's Department of Public Safety has expected students, faculty, and staff to opt into that notification system. That policy has come under scrutiny in recent days, no surprise, after a series of alerts made folks more aware of the system and how it differs between the different sorts of assaults. So joining us today to talk about those systems at Ohio State University and other campuses around the country is Columbus Dispatch higher education reporter Ankarnita Pyle. Ankarnita, thanks for joining us.
Pleasure.
And also with us, WOSU reporter Mandy Trimble. Hi, Mandy.
Good morning, Ann.
Joining us a little bit later to talk about that greater overall problem of sexual assault and violence on college campuses is Terry O'Neill. She's the president of the National Organization Women. Violence against women is among NOW's six core issues these days. I guess rape falls into that category, right, Terry?
Yes, it does.
Thanks for being with us. And Nancy Radcliffe, coordinator of the Campus Advocacy Program at the Student Wellness Center. Nancy, thanks for being here.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Ankarnita, can you explain the OSU policy as it stands and let me know if I mucked it up at all in my introduction?
No, absolutely. You were dead on. In fact, OSU, like many campuses across the country, they do have to report violent crimes. The violent crime category includes some other lesser crimes like robbery and burglary. But essentially, they have to report these in a timely fashion to the campus community. And these are crimes that occur both on and off campus. Now, the federal government does leave some leeway as to how they go about doing that. And I think that's where a lot of the criticism and the scrutiny has come to play, because it's been very uneven among campuses across the country and how it is that they report the crimes to students, faculty, staff, community members. Some do mass mailings. Others, like Ohio State, do the opt-in system.
Is that just for sexual assaults or for all the violent crimes?
That's for all the crimes that they report through the CLEARI Act.
The CLEARI Act. Where's that from, Mandy?
It's federal law.
That's the name of the
federal law. I want to say it was from, and I may be wrong, was it the 80s?
Yeah, 1986, there was a young woman named Jean Cleary who was murdered on a campus in Pennsylvania. And ever since then, campuses have had to report these crimes.
Yeah, I think the law passed in 1990. It was called the Student Right to Know Act. It was amended in 1992 and expanded to include more crimes, and then in 1998 expanded again. How is the CLEARI Act enforced?
Well, it depends, Anne. Do we want to talk about other universities, or do we want to look at OSU right now?
Let's just take OSU.
Okay. At OSU, there are two ways that they do that. They have crime alerts. Well, let's talk about the crime alerts right now. It's for any offense, really, at OSU, and it varies from campus to campus. OSU sends out crime alerts for homicides, sexual offenses, some of the worst hate crimes. But they also send out crime alerts for crime against properties.
Break-ins,
theft, auto theft. It varies, and it's also up to their discretion when to send them out, too.
And now, I got an alert the other day after the murder-suicide that occurred on campus a couple days ago, but I didn't get an alert for the other incidents. Has something changed quickly?
Well, it's funny that you say that, Ann, because just last week when the sexual assault occurred, I interviewed Paul Denton. He's the OSU police chief. And at the time I was doing some research, I went online, looked at their online daily crime log that they have. Every crime that happens goes on this crime log. I registered. So I don't know if there's some kind of disconnect, because you said you received a crime alert. I didn't. So I'm not really sure what's happening there. I know that OSU was looking at changing its opt-in policy. I called and tried to reach out to Mr. Denton today, Chief Denton. Haven't quite heard from him yet on where they stand with that. But right now it's opt-in. You have to sign up for these text messages and emails.
Now, I hate opt-in things because I always think there's some scam involved. So I just sort of, as a religion, do not go opt-in to anything. But Ankarnita, is that the way it is in the around the rest of the country?
You know, it really depends, although most campuses actually just do the mass emails and the mass emails, because that way they know that everyone will know about it as quick as possible, and there's no room for error that way. I mean, everyone's going to get – I mean, they know how to contact everyone on campus anyways, because they send them alerts about other things, and they tell them about their bills and those kinds of things.
And they could reach people at OSU the same way, right, Mandy?
Did
they
say, absolutely.
You know, any explanation –
as to why it's an opt-in?
Yeah.
No, I haven't really heard why it's an opt-in. And anyone can get this. It doesn't have to be just OSU. Parents can sign up for this. Media can sign up for this. You just have to go online to do it. But there was no really good reason why it's an opt-in. You know, I talked to a couple of universities last week, and the University of Texas has an opt-out policy. So all students are automatically registered. It's part of registration for the text alert messages. And they have the option to opt out if they don't want it. You know, to me, that kind of seems the way to go. That way everyone's already on the register. And they also do mass emails. Everyone gets it. You don't have to opt in for these. You automatically get it.
And was that a no-brainer to them, or was there some policy?
They were doing this before Virginia Tech, about a year before Virginia Tech. So this wasn't kind of on the heels of that tragedy.
I guess the Virginia Tech incident is obviously the best example right now. That changed a lot of policies around the country. So I was surprised to hear that it was opt-in at Ohio State.
Well, and then with the Virginia Tech, that also, I think, and this kind of confuses the matter, but that is when, after the Virginia Tech incident, Ohio State created its Buckeye Alert system, which is a whole nother system
for
an active shooter or shooter at the workplace violence, which we had just yesterday morning.
Okay. Maybe that's probably what I've got then, a Buckeye Alert.
Exactly. Or if there's a tornado. And so it's a different system, and they treat that as a system where they alert anyone who, again, has opted into the system, and it's text messages or calls on your cell phone. It'd be a voicemail message. And it's for those immediate situations. And both Chief Denton and the deputy chief at Ohio State said that it differs in that that's a situation where they want to tell the campus community about things that they need to worry about their safety at
immediately.
That moment. Immediately.
Right. It's not limited to crime either, the Buckeye Alert. There could be a tornado headed this way. There could be a large hazardous spill where people need to act immediately. But again, you have to opt in for this. So I think that's something that they're supposed to be taking a good look at, because last week
you have to opt in for the Buckeye Alert.
You have to opt in for everything.
I don't know. Maybe I did it. I don't remember doing it. How do you do this, anyways?
I did it online.
Where do you go?
I went to the Ohio State Department of help me out here, folks.
Public Safety.
Thank you,
Public
Department
Safety.
Of Public Safety.
Uh-huh.
And on the left side of the page, it says Buckeye Alert. You sign up. You give them your email and your cell phone number, your provider, whether it's Verizon or whomever, and they automatically send it to you. Now, I got one, but I didn't get one the other day, so I don't know what's going on there.
I think what happens is individuals might sign up for one and think that they'll automatically get the other.
Right.
And you're not going to, and you need to sign up every year. You can't just sign up your freshman year and think that you're going to get those alerts all the time. And a lot of people don't know the difference.
Yeah, I went out and talked to students after the sexual assault happened to find out, did you get the crime alert email? And they said, oh, no, I didn't get it. I'm not sure why. Well, the reason why is because they had to opt in and they had no idea. So I took that to Chief Denton, and he said, obviously, we need to revisit this.
Nancy Radcliffe of the Campus Advocacy Program at the Student Wellness Center. Why are there two different triggers, for one for just garden variety violent crime, I guess, and another one for sexual assault?
Well, I can't speak to the notification rationale.
Okay.
I can tell you that what I have been told is that they are taking a look at these systems and they're evaluating changes at this moment. So that's good news.
Mm-hmm.
I also want to let people know that after the sexual assaults happened, and Dr. Adams Gaston, our VP for Student Life, sent an email out to all students. And in that email, she had a link where people could click on it to pull up the page so that they could register for the crime alerts, because they are two separate things. You register for the crime alert and or the Buckeye Alert. So in her email, she did have a link so students could do that and that they would be informed that way. She also had a link to our office, the Sexual Violence Education and Support Program, to try to let students know a little bit about some of the support services that exist here.
Do you think it's important for parents to sign up for these things as well?
Yes. I believe that people can make good decisions with good information. And I think that you don't have to live in fear, but you can certainly be more educated and more aware and then make decisions based on that.
As far as the law goes and how the universities are supposed to send in these reports once a year, about 80% of them do, which is, apparently the good news. But what about the 20% that don't? And what is there in federal law that can force them to? Is there any? Do we know?
I can speak
okay,
to that.
Okay, Nancy.
The Jean Cleary Act actually complemented the campus security laws that existed. Okay. We also have Title IX, which is another federal piece of legislation that dictates procedures, rules, policies for college campuses around these issues. So the Department of Education oversees the enforcement of these federal laws, and they can contact universities and check on their compliance, and they do regularly. So it's actually something that is monitored by the Department of Education, and complaints are processed through them.
And if you don't?
It affects a number of things. And I know this, this doesn't help, but part of it is it can affect funding. It's definitely a part of the funding stream that universities and colleges have across the country that help us do programming.
Does it apply to all colleges and universities, private and public?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. If you want to, sorry, Anconita.
Yeah, I did want to add that, and it isn't like universities don't get docked or get called on the mat for making mistakes. I mean, Ohio State about 3.5 years ago did get asked why it was only reporting sexual assaults involving strangers and not cases involving acquaintances. Mm-hmm. So, of course, Ohio State changed its policy. And then the Center for Public Integrity, it's a watchdog journalism group in Washington, D.C. They are in the midst of publishing a 3-part series on sexual assaults on campus.
Right.
And there's been a lot of, there have been some criticisms of the law being really uneven. And a lot of cases, the sexual assaults, or even if it's been very clear that there's been a rape or sexual assault, that the campuses may not do enough to punish individuals and to really take care of, or the victims just feel as though the system's not working for them.
Yeah, I want to get to that later because I saw the NPR reports with that organization as well. They've been doing a joint operation. But before we go to the break, and we have to go to a break soon, what are the updates on the crimes that triggered all of this discussion in the first place? Do you know?
The updates on crimes at OSU.
Well, the sexual assault outside the laboratory.
I don't know of if they have found who the assailant was. Mm-hmm. I don't know of any update on that. That yet. Yeah.
Anything. And then the three guys that were allegedly assaulted in the dormitory. Anything?
Again, I can't speak to where the police are with these investigations, but I'm aware that they are active investigations and that the police went as public as they did with information about the recent the two cases that were linked with the three young men,
right,
in hopes that people would take a look at the picture and help them possibly identify the individuals involved. So I can't speak for OSU police, but I feel certain in saying that if people would still be willing to do that, it could be very helpful.
Okay. If you want to opt into the Buckeye Alert, go to our website at WOSU.org/allsides, and we'll have a link for you right there. We have to take a quick break right now, but if you want to talk about these issues in more detail, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@WOSU.org. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
And good morning from WOSU 820 NPR News. Get the latest information from WOSU the way you want it, daily, biweekly, or monthly. Go to WOSU.org/email and sign up for one of our WOSU e-newsletters. 52 degrees in downtown Columbus at 11:20. Cloudy skies today. There is a chance of rain and a high of 62. Clouds tonight, a low of 45 degrees. Clouds on Thursday and a good chance of morning rain. Maybe a few thunderstorms Thursday afternoon and a high of 62 degrees.
Support for the Statehouse News Bureau stories on WOSU comes from the Ohio Education Association, representing 131,000 teachers, support professionals, and higher education faculty who are working for great public schools for every child. Online at OHEA.org.
All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about Gosh, what are we talking about? We're talking about sexual assaults on our university campuses and what we do to protect the folks who are could be victimized by this, and also what the universities and colleges in the United States are required to do, a la the Clery Act, which has been around since 1990. Nancy, what have we learned from the Clery Act statistics?
Well, the Clery Act really made it a huge issue for college campuses, universities across our country to kind of take a look at what we were doing and what we needed to do to be in compliance with the Clery Act. At Ohio State, there's been an ongoing team that has looked at Clery reporting and are we doing what we need to be doing and how are things being reported. And I think that's been great because on the one hand, it's a complex issue with a lot of problems. And people misunderstand the Clery statistics too, frankly, because, you know, statistics are confusing and you have to understand what they mean and what the source is. But the Clery statistics are something that is a way for parents and students to take a quick look at different colleges and universities, see what they're reporting, see if that makes sense based on the information they have about how sexual assaults happen on college campuses, and then make decisions based on that. So, for example, colleges and universities have been accused of brushing things under the carpet, just to put it that way. And there's lots of ways that information is protected at the university. That's part of it. Another part of it is the issue itself. And I know we're going to talk about all of this later. But, for example, the Clery takes a look at forcible or non-forcible sex offenses. And when people see forcible sex offenses, they think of rape. But a forcible sex offense is not only rape, and it is not necessarily a rape that involves force. So I think there's really some confusion even about the Clery statistics and what they tell parents or students about what happens on a college campus.
I wanted to welcome to the show as well Terry O'Neill. She is president of the National Organization for Women. Terry, are you satisfied with how the Clery Act works?
No, not at all. The Department of Education can do a much better job of implementing and enforcing the Clery Act. There's too many schools that really are not in compliance. And in particular, the one of the amendments to the Clery Act required that colleges undertake prevention policies and institute them. And there's some real problems with very few colleges or far too few colleges. And universities have taken seriously the prevention aspect of the Clery Act and the telling students what they can do, sort of laying out a set of guidelines of what they can do if they've been attacked. It's also really important for colleges and universities to talk about talk to bystanders about what they should do to intervene, to report, to stop the behavior, and so forth. So there's a huge room for improvement in this.
We were talking earlier about the Ohio State University is reconsidering its policy, and I read that they actually, 3 years ago when they established this policy, the alert policy, they said that's what everybody wanted. And I'm trying to figure out, how are they reconsidering it now? Do you know what the process is as they reconsider? Yeah, Mandy, I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. I don't know what they're reconsidering the opt-in policy. And as I said earlier, I tried to reach out to OSU Police Chief Paul Denton to find out where they stand on that. Right now, I don't think there's a lot of information out there about what it is they're looking to do. I know last week when a number of students didn't know they had to opt in, they thought they were supposed to get these emails automatically. That's when Chief Denton said, well, this is a great opportunity for us to re-educate students on what they need to do. But again, after there was so much scrutiny on this, they're looking at changing that. But what they're looking to do, I don't know at this point.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah,
Terry.
This is Terry. I mean, I wonder whether the majority, as I understand, the majority of rapes on college campuses involve students who know one another and
are acquainted with one another.
With one another, and they involve alcohol. And I don't know if the university's policy with this alert thing, when you have a classic example of students drinking too much, and then a male student rapes a female student. Because she's drunk and it's obvious that he can. I don't know if that would be the subject even of an alert, and I wonder if I'm just curious as to whether that would be.
That's a good question, Mandy. You're shaking your head.
It's not at OSU. If it's a sexual assault where the woman knows who it is, OSU generally, according to Police Chief Denton, that they would not issue an alert.
If he or she knows
the person.
What's interesting, you know, the findings from the Center for Public Integrity, one of the myths that they have addressed in their research, and including research by, David Lisak, is that even in this case of acquaintance rapes, the perpetrator is typically a serial rapist. This is not a one-time event typically. Nancy?
Can I jump in here?
Yeah, sure.
OSU police actually have issued crime alerts this past year that involved acquaintances or people who were known to the victim. The discussion, as I understand it, is does this alert benefit students? Does it benefit students? Does it help aid with the capture of an individual? And those are the discussions, I think, that have happened that have led to OSU police, before all of this happened, issuing crime alerts that were non-stranger scenarios.
Do they do it uniformly, or do they talk about it case-by-case basis?
I can't speak for OSU police. I know, though, that one of the complex pieces of all of this is the fear that oftentimes survivors have of this becoming big, of the media getting hold of their cases.
Right. And the dichotomy, the great dichotomy.
Exactly. And so there's a balancing act that happens by the university, which is the desire of the individual to remain anonymous, as was the case with the first sexual assault, the first rape that happened on campus, with the right to know of the public and public safety. I worry about that individual because not only did she want to remain anonymous, but she wasn't able to do so. Once that crime alert went out, actually a picture of where she lived was in the news, and I don't know what purpose that served. The sexual assault didn't happen where she lived. And I fear that when sometimes we take these crime alerts and make them big and don't critically think about the impact of the information we're releasing, what it could do is discourage reporting. And that's one of my fears with this issue.
Mandy, did you want to add something there?
I did, and I wanted to make sure that I didn't mean to say that they would never, that OSU would never issue a crime alert in the event of an acquaintance rape. Chief Denton says that they look at every crime alert and evaluate them before they send them out, and he underscored last week that there has to be an ongoing threat. So say an individual is acquainted with women, and whoever is doing the assault, I think would generate a crime alert.
Okay. If you want to join the conversation, 614-292-8513. And Chris, you're on the air. Hi. Chris?
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
There's a number of prevention programs available throughout the community. In OSU has a program. A number of police departments offer programs. There's a nationally affiliated organization called Impact, and they all kind of offer different programs. Some of them are like 1 or 2 hour skill-based. Impact is a research-based program that it goes much deeper into prevention issues. And I'm wondering if the panelists would discuss how people who want to select a prevention program might go about doing that.
That's a good question, Chris. Thanks for your call.
Is it okay if I respond?
Yeah, Nancy, please do.
Well, before I do, let me just clarify my statement from before. I can't speak to personal knowledge. I'm just speaking based on what I've read in the media about these cases. So I just want to be clear.
Nancy does not represent the Ohio State University. We did ask for a representative from the Department of Public Safety to join us on the show, and I guess things are a little busy around there, and they didn't have anybody to send. So just to make that clarification.
Thank you.
Go ahead, Nancy.
Well, my position at the university is to provide advocacy to students primarily who've experienced sexual assault, stalking, intimate partner abuse, and sexual harassment. And I'm part of the Sexual Violence Education and Support Program at the Student Wellness Center. And we've been offering education and prevention programming since our office was established. And we've been offering women's self-defense for over 25 years to women in the community as well as OSU students. But besides our education prevention efforts, there are other entities that provide those kinds of workshops on campus, too. OSU police offer a self-defense class for women especially, and they're called the RAD classes, and people can look them up there. And as your caller noted, there are excellent resources in the community, such as impact safety programs. So if people want to find out about sort of the education and prevention that our office offers, we will gladly encourage people to check out our website.
Let me approach it from a little bit different point of view, because the LISAC studies, which was based, I think, 20,000 college men from across the country, pointed out that one of the things is that they don't think of themselves as rapists. Usually they know the other student and they don't use guns or knives. And so they don't know. So what about educating the perpetrators? Terry?
Well, I was just going to say, I think a number of colleges, I think, around the country are looking at what really best practices around prevention. And some colleges, for example, don't require all incoming freshman students to undergo a prevention training sort of program. Some colleges have a video that you watch for 20 minutes, which really doesn't get into specific definitions of behaviors so that both men and women understand, you know, what actually is sexual assault. A lot of young men and young women are very confused about what constitutes sexual assault. And so if you have prevention that's required of all the students coming in, and possibly even required every year for students to engage in it, and the prevention program should be something that's very specific, defines the behaviors, gives examples of the types of behaviors that would constitute sexual assault. And also the best practices would be not only to encourage to emphasize the importance of not abusing alcohol and drugs, because the abuse of alcohol and drugs makes a young woman much more vulnerable to attack. But also it needs to equally emphasize the responsibility of young men not to commit sexual assaults and not to kid themselves or be able to get into denial about what really constitutes sexual assault. A lot of these predators have very clear strategies of, you know, finding a victim, using alcohol to rape the victim, and then claiming that it was consensual. And the reason I think one of the reasons this is so effective on the part of predators is that in order to overcome that kind of, oh, it was consensual, and I have my constitutional rights, and I've been accused, and poor me, the young woman is required to drop all of her studies and focus almost exclusively on pursuing her case, because very often she doesn't get enough help from the school administrator. So she's really the one, often she and her parents, are the ones who are really pushing the case, but she doesn't have time to do her studies.
Mm-hmm.
A large number of women drop out of school altogether precisely because when they've been raped, the guy that raped her is walking around on campus threatening her, or she feels threatened by him, and she just decides, you know, life is too short, I can't deal with this, and she drops out of school. It's a tragedy.
Nancy, what about OSU? What do they do to educate people, including potential perpetrators?
Well, I wholeheartedly agree that we need to direct our prevention efforts two different ways than people typically think of them. One is by talking and educating about sex offenders. We really like David Lisak's research. It's consistent with other research and other data that's available on this issue. We even brought him to OSU last year and opened it up to people in Ohio, to training officers and so on. So there's primary prevention, which you do to address potential perpetrators and to make it obvious to a college culture that this is not acceptable behavior. These guys cannot fly under the radar because their behaviors, their attitudes, their actions are looked at as not just part of college culture, as something problematic. So that's one piece, addressing in your prevention efforts sort of how do you get at primary prevention of sex offenders. And then the other part is the bystander intervention piece. So at OSU, we try to do both. We have a men's initiative that just, it's working right now to develop sort of what it's going to do as far as prevention goes and approaching men directly. But we've also been working on a week of awareness events and how we can help raise students' awareness about this. It's been actually scheduled for a while. It's going to be April 19th through the 23rd. But we do ongoing prevention at the university.
You know, now that you mention it, when I was thinking of bystanders, I guess I was thinking of friends of the victim, making mm-hmm. sure they don't, mm-hmm. you know, make poor choices. But the other bystanders, of course, are friends of the perpetrator
exactly.
who know that there might be a problem.
Right. People who can have those check-in conversations, people who see an unsafe situation developing and intervene. You know, what do you do when you see someone who's really drunk or incapacitated at a party? Hopefully there's a good person who intervenes, who helps that person get home safely, who makes sure that they are not so intoxicated that there could be problems during the night, who turns them on their side, who puts a trash can by the bed. We really mm-hmm. want to encourage people to take care of each other and look out for the people who think that that's a great time to take advantage of the situation to do what they want to do instead.
We're going to take a short break, and then we'll get back to your calls and emails, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. If you have a story to tell about your own experience, give us a call, 614-292-8513. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
This is Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air, and I'm on a roll. It's been more than a year since a guest walked out on one of my interviews, but honestly, by the time you hear this, my luck may have run out. Tune in and see on the next Fresh Air.
And Fresh Air begins in just about 20 minutes. It starts at noon. And on Fresh Air, NPR Iraq correspondent Deborah Amos tells us why the United Nations has had to rethink aid to middle-class Iraqi refugees who are college graduates and professionals. That discussion is at noon on Fresh Air right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. And corporate partners help provide support for WOSU. Your business can join them and reach an educated, engaged, appreciative audience every day. Be associated with a trusted local and national source for accurate news coverage. For more information, contact Christine at 247-4469. And thank you for supporting WOSU 820 NPR News. 53 degrees in downtown Columbus, cloudy skies today and a high of 62, clouds tonight and a low of 45, clouds for Thursday and a chance of morning rain, maybe some thunderstorms Thursday afternoon and a high of 62 degrees, more rain Thursday night and more rain expected on Friday as well. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I have a big crew in here today, so I want to go back and remind you who we're talking to. Terry O'Neill, she's the president of the National Organization for Women. Violence against women is among NOW's six core issues these days. And Terry, thanks again for being with us.
Thank you, Ann.
Also, Nancy Radcliffe, she's the coordinator of the Campus Advocacy Program at the Student Wellness Center at Ohio State University. Nancy, again, thanks for joining us.
I'm glad to be here.
And then from the news side of this show, we have Encarnita Pyle. She is a reporter at the Columbus Dispatch. Thanks, Encarnita, for being with us.
Thanks, Ann.
And finally, Mandy Trimble. She is a WOSU reporter. Mandy, thanks again.
Thank you.
We have a couple calls to take, 614-292-8513. Dan, you're on the air.
Yes. Just a couple questions. How much data collection is there to try to solve this problem? How much science do we have? Like, what are the age of the perpetrators, the locations? Do they use, like, tacks on a map to show where the locations are? What schools are worse than others about reporting and that kind of stuff? Do they have a profile for alleged offenders? Are high-profile athletes more apt to have a sense of entitlement, maybe be more of a predator type?
Okay. Dan, Nancy, do you want to – Nancy or Terry? Nancy?
Wow. There were a lot of good questions in that statement, so I'm not sure where to start. There is a lot of data. There is luckily – colleges and universities have been taking a look at this issue for a while now. Mary Picos, who's, I believe, at Arizona State University now, sorry if I get that wrong, she did sort of a research project that sort of set the standards for other research projects that took a look at it. So basically, from her research and sort of David Lisak's research and other research that's been committed on other college campuses and universities, is there's some information about sex offenders, but sex offenders are a pretty wide category of people. So there's other data, like, I don't mean to just keep talking about research, but I like research a lot. So what we do know is that a lot of times people who commit these types of crimes don't identify that what they did was a sexual assault. Even if they hear the legal definition and admit to doing the legal definition, they still don't think that what they did was a crime because there's always justification or rationale. And that's true of all sex offenders, by the way. But where we get stuck is a lot of times the way sex offenses are committed, it's without witnesses. And so I know people have heard the phrase, he said, she said. I don't like that phrase at all. Sex offenses happen against men. Females can be perpetrators. But anyway, what we try to do is educate law enforcement and medical personnel and all of us who provide support services to be able to identify these and kind of track what we're doing and what we're not doing. What we see at the university is there's a sexual violence committee that's been meeting. We've been meeting for a number of years now. And one of the things that the sexual violence committee does is we take a look at what trends there may be. And we discuss what are some of the education prevention efforts to address the trends. How can we disseminate information effectively to the campus community? How can we let faculty and staff know that there's this resource at the university? We're a very large university, so it's always a challenge to get the best information out there.
Yes. Terry?
Yeah, mm-hmm. It's according to the Department of Justice in 2005, they put out a study on the Clery Act and reporting. And one of the things they noted was that there was a problem with reporting under the Clery Act, and that is the definition itself of sexual assault. One of the things that the Department of Justice found was that only a slight majority of the schools studied even mentioned acquaintance rape in their sexual assault response policy. So it's not clear that the schools are gathering information. Some schools use a definition of sexual assault that's based on their state law, and state laws on rape vary from state to state. Some schools use the definitions that they've developed internally to the school. Some use other definitions. So there's an issue in terms of the science. I really think that there's huge room for improvement in the science. And the other problem is the question of the university's ability to gather data. If students are not trained, and I think really yearly training is a good idea, to identify sexual assault, and particularly bystanders, friends of the victim. These really are the first responders in many cases. If they're not able to tell their friend that what you experienced was sexual assault under the school's policy, you should report it. Then the school can't gather the information, and the Department of Education can't really get a good sense around the country of what is really going on. And very importantly, because of these reporting problems, we are not able to identify and apprehend serial rapists. And there's a study, there's a recent study that came out that indicates that you may have a number of serial rapists on campuses that are committing, you know, sort of a disproportionately large number of the rapes that are happening.
But if everybody doesn't report them, then you don't see the pattern.
Exactly. And if the reporting is really not following best practices, then it's impossible for the school to see the pattern and go in and get this one serial rapist off campus and behind bars. One of the things that I think also that colleges and universities really need to do, and it's a little scary for them to do this, is they need to lay out in writing and make this very much available to the students exactly what the student's recourse is, not just inside the school, but also under federal law. So the student has certain rights under the Clery Act, and the student has certain rights not to be discriminated against under Title IX. And it is discrimination if rape victims are routinely sort of not responded to in a good way by universities, and it does happen. That happens around the country. Another federal law that is very recent that's useful for students, and students should be told that it's available to them, is the hate crimes bill. The hate crimes law was recently amended to include gender as a basis for committing a hate crime. So gang rape, for example, would be a hate crime.
I thought that was part of the Clery Act. It's not. Okay. I'm getting shaking heads. Okay.
Right, right. No. So, but it's a gang rape is I think almost universally recognized as a hate crime. And so students should be told that they have a right, and that the hate crimes law is administered by the Department of Justice, not the Department of Education. So if the Department of Education is not doing a good job for a student, she should be able to go to the Department of Justice under the hate crimes law if in fact her experience is the result of a serial rapist. Or if she experienced gang rape, which happens on college campuses.
Okay.
So,
and Karnita, did you want?
Yeah, I wanted to follow up on one of the things that Terry mentioned, and that was the uneven reporting. One of the things I've never gotten a very good answer from any of the schools is it's one thing to collect the information, but how are you using the statistics? Because often I've talked to safety officials, and they'll just say, "Well, we just put out our annual report, and we're not analyzing it." And why is it useful then? Why collect it?
Nancy?
Well, I can't speak to what other colleges and universities do. I can tell you that what we have tried to do here at Ohio State is to encourage reporting, which is even going two steps backwards, because one of the issues is to whom do you report it? Mm-hmm. Who do you report a crime to? At the university, not just our university, but at universities and colleges across the country, there's usually a student judicial affairs process or student judiciary process.
If it's another student.
If the alleged perpetrator is a student. Doesn't matter who the victim is. The victim mm-hmm. can be
okay.
a member of the community.
Okay.
The only thing that's relevant is if the alleged perpetrator is a student.
Okay.
Then the student judiciary process is available for people as a way to report and begin a process. The other way to report it would be to police or to a university official who would then go forward with the report. Now, one issue is that a lot of times people that I work with may not want to report it. That is a huge decision, and people weigh that decision. Coming forward, having that information be known, how that will affect parents' reactions to them, what's going to be disclosed, what mm-hmm. will actually happen if they do report it. These are conversations that we have with students and members of the community as soon as we can have them, whether that's in the emergency department or over at the Student Health Center or in my office. So we try to debunk what reporting actually means as a way to help people understand that they can report it and to whom they can report it. And then we have the other issues that Terry mentioned.
Let's take a couple phone calls, 614-292-8513. Adam, you're on the air. You want to talk about protocols? This is kind of interesting on the lack of consent versus regret of victim. Tell me what you mean by that.
Well, I was wondering if there are any protocols either on file or just in practice that help sort out who may be a perpetrator of this absolutely horrendous type of attack versus a alleged victim that may actually just be experiencing regret in having the sexual encounter to begin with. Because I think that could possibly lead to wasted resources. And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank
you. All right. Adam, thanks. Nancy?
Well, I think there's a couple parts to his question. One is that Ohio law says consent is very much a part of our definitions for rape. And the ability to give consent is crucial. So, for example, one of our laws talks about if a victim is substantially impaired, which means that if they're substantially impaired, they're unable to give consent. So the issue of consent is huge, and that's part of the decision that an individual weighs about reporting it. Will they be believed, or will people think that this was just regretted sex, as the caller said? So a lot of times when I meet with people, they're still in the process of wrapping their brains around what just happened. Whatever type of crime they've experienced, there's mm-hmm. usually a period of shock that people go through, and then they try to figure out what to do about it. So the question that the caller raised is a key question. When can you give consent? When can you not? What does consent have to look like? Some people think you have to say no. You don't have to say no. Some people think you have to physically resist. You don't have to physically resist under Ohio law. So the discussion about consent is something that we do in all of our education prevention programming, and it's an important conversation to have with everybody around this issue.
You know, I get that that there's all these shades of gray now, and that the research is bearing these out, and it's very, very well recognized now. But Terry, how in the world do you prosecute these kinds of things? How I know that the Center for Public Integrity reported that colleges almost never expel men who are found responsible for sexual assaults. How do they – is that a function of the difficulty of prosecuting something like this?
No, it's not. It's a – well, the difficulty of prosecuting something like this is really a function of, I think, a sort of society-wide refusal to recognize mm-hmm. rape for the crime that it is. I mean, I heard a lot of – I heard some compassion, I think, and some concern in the caller – in the caller's question for – what do you do with some poor guy who's drunk? He sees that she's drunk. He's going to have sex with her. He just wants to have a good time. And then whap, does his entire college career go down the drain?
Mm-hmm.
You know, is he going to be punished for the rest of his life just for one silly little moment of inebriated pleasure?
In other words, he doesn't fit the profile.
He doesn't fit the profile. The fact is he does fit the profile, and the young man should be put in prison. And, mm-hmm. and I think the caller is having a hard time, and many people have a hard time wrapping their brains around that. But the reality is that that this sense of privilege is damaging. When you act on your sense of privilege to have sex with a person who is inebriated and not able to give consent, I think that you have committed a crime and you really do belong in prison. The real problem, and I experienced this when I was a couple of years ago, I was advocating for a law around rape in the state of Maryland. The proposed law was simply to say that when the rape produces a child, and this mostly happens in incest with repeated rapes, if the rape produces a child, that there could be a procedure for terminating the parental rights of the rapist. So the rapist can't take custody of the child, especially if the rapist is a pedophile, you kind of want to do that. We ran into a brick wall of opposition by the male-dominated committee that was assigned to consider this bill, and their concern was that, as one man expressed it, he said, the worst thing that could ever happen to a man is to be accused of rape. And so they were they did not want to allow any opportunity for a rapist to have his his father's rights terminated. They were very concerned that should not happen because there was a possibility that someday, at some point, that accusation of rape might not be entirely true, and for that reason, all the rapists should continue to have access to their victim. I mean, this is the society that we're living in.
Nancy, did you have a thought about that?
I had a lot of thoughts about that, and I agree with her. I think that. What I hear oftentimes is expressed concern for the alleged offender, and what people continue to miss is how difficult it is for survivors to come forward. Nobody wants this type of attention. You want attention for your accomplishments. You want attention for your intelligence or your whatever. You don't want people to think about you as the victim of this type of crime. It's a very private, very personal crime. And I think what people miss is that it's still a very underreported crime. So they're erring on some concerns about innocent people, and I absolutely share their concerns about innocent people being falsely accused and in prison, but there's a whole investigatory process and a whole prosecution that can happen that helps take a look at which cases move forward and which don't move forward. And I still see that there's a lot of cases that go underreported or don't get prosecuted. And I think we still have a way to go on that end.
You know, this might sound like a little bit of a left turn, but I'm kind of intrigued by one of our callers waiting to talk. He wants to kind of make a parallel between kids who are physically abused, say, at summer camp and they or anywhere in schools in our societies, at least a proclivity to overlook those things sometimes. Jerome, you're on the air.
Yeah. My kids went to summer camp, and when they came back, one of our children was very different, and it took months to figure out what it was, finally had them in counseling, find out they were being bullied. And all along the camp was telling us nothing ever happened. When I confronted the camp on it, I went with the idea that they really didn't know. And then they said, oh, yeah, we knew all along. Mm. And so I wrote them this letter saying, you know, okay, we need to resolve these issues. And I wasn't out suing them. I just said, we need to sit down and figure out what went wrong and fix it.
The proverbial closure. Yeah.
Right. And for us, we wanted them to take some responsibility. We weren't looking for blood money mm-hmm. or anything. We hadn't even thought about asking for our money.
But this discussion spurred this thought in you, that it's the same sort of thing?
Very similar. The resistance, they ended up having their lawyer sending us a letter saying they were going to sue us for libel.
Wow.
And
okay.
We're sort of trapped in that similar sort of, you know, paralysis of how do you move forward?
Okay.
And who do you turn to? You know, everyone says, well, it's not in my jurisdiction.
Interesting.
Right.
Well, Jerome, thanks. That's an interesting idea. Terry.
Yeah, this is Terry. It's also true that school administrators are faced with a very competitive world. You are constantly trying to get the best students to come to your university. Private universities are expensive, and so you really it's highly competitive. And the last thing school administrators want or need is to have to tell prospective parents that their campus is more dangerous than other campuses. So there's this whole thing, and I don't know how administrators go about finding out, you know, am I in the norm? Do I have what? Look at my statistics for rape on campus. Where do I fit in within the industry? I don't know if that information is even available to administrators. And I think that the response, therefore, is to try to downplay the level of assaults on campus and even things like bullying, because you want the parents to feel good about sending their kids to this school.
We got nods all around here. Nancy, did you want to add something or anybody? Yeah.
Well, I would just add, first of all, my heart goes out to the caller, and it does sound familiar. I mean, what we thought we knew about people who committed violence against women, children, and men, and what we've come to learn is actually changed over the years. For example, we see that stalking behaviors on campuses or intimate partner abuse that happens with college students, it's bullying, it's harassment. So I think there are parallels to be drawn between how things are handled and understood. Absolutely. I think, though, one thing that is a challenge at OSU is we're a very large university that is set within a very large city. And so we try to make sure that we gather data and that we look at it and we discuss it and the implications for it. But I wanted to just say that there's funding for colleges and universities across the country through the Violence Against Women Act. The okay. Department of Justice has actually funded positions like mine at colleges and universities to provide programs and positions like mine to help students who have experienced these crimes so that they can stay in school and they can graduate. And so I'm just one part of a support network here at the university, but my position was initially grant funded, but when the administration saw that it was needed and worthwhile, mm-hmm. they made it a permanent position a few years ago.
You know, we only have about a minute and a half left. I want to try to grab this last call. Molly, you're on the air. We don't have a lot of time, so
okay,
speak
I just
quickly.
Have a quick question.
Yep.
I wondered about coordination between universities, maybe in the same metropolitan area or even larger, one to catch what exactly is going on at any given minute, mm-hmm. see any patterns, and then in a larger scale to see if there were any trends in certain types of crime or new drugs used or something like that.
Okay.
Off the air.
Thanks, Molly. I don't know if we have time to answer that question, but Nancy, do you want to give a go and give me about 15 seconds?
Well, I think it's a great idea. There's actually the Central Ohio Sexual Assault Task Force that's hosted by the local Rape Crisis Center, which is SARNCO. Again, another acronym that stands for the Sexual Assault Response Network of Central Ohio. And community providers and the university and other colleges and universities are welcome to attend this meeting. And we do talk about some of these types of cases and what we're seeing and we're not seeing. So if people wanted to find out more about that, they could contact the Sexual Assault Response Network of Central Ohio. And they're part of Ohio Health, so you can find them that way.
We're out of time. Terry O'Neill, president of the National Organization for Women, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Also, Nancy Radcliffe at OSU, where she is the campus advocacy. She is coordinator of the campus advocacy program at the Student Wellness Center, and also dispatch reporter and Carnita Pyle, and WOSU reporter Mandy Trimble. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is listener supported WOSU and WOSU HD 820 Columbus, and streaming on the web at WOSU.org, WOSU 820, NPR News.